Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 328 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be talking about vitamin B12 deficiency. Vitamin B12 deficiency is a big topic, shows up on exams in many different ways. And it's just something that, unfortunately, many people don't really understand as well as they should. So today I'm going to try to break it down. And I'm going to focus especially on the things that they love to test on MBME exams. And before I go into that, I just want to announce, as a reminder, if you're taking step 2 CQ, step 3 anytime soon, I do have multiple review courses coming up this week and pretty much every 2 weeks afterwards. The one that's coming up soon is going to be this, starting on Thursday this week, with an MBME test taking strategies course. It's going to be from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that's like 5 to 7:30 Eastern Standard Time on Thursday. Basically, in that course, we go over very high fidelity means of analyzing exam questions, picking out the correct answers to exam questions, approaching ethics questions. We even discuss ways to get the answers right, even for questions where you don't really know the content. And then we have an review course. It's going to be 20 hours long. And it's going to be taking place on Friday and Saturday. It's going to be 10 hours each day. At least, hopefully, that should help people that work or something. You can probably take Friday off of work and then work, attend the course on Friday and Saturday. Everything is over Zoom. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I still have spots remaining, and I'll be glad to sign you up. I'll give you some more information on cost and things of that nature. We cover a ton of material in those courses. And again, I've had many people take these courses and do extremely well. Okay, so let's just go ahead and jump right into it, right? So vitamin B12 deficiency, right? Remember, we also call this cobalamin deficiency. I think one thing that may just kind of help is having like a good general overview first of normal B12 physiology. So today, in today's podcast, I'm going to really try to hone in on normal B12 physiology. I'm going to talk about the different causes of vitamin B12 deficiency. I will try, if I can, to discuss on how a B12 deficiency may be diagnosed. And then we'll talk about treatment. And then we'll talk about some pathologies that are associated with B12 deficiency. Right. So the first thing with normal physiology of vitamin B12, right? So the thing is, you need to consume animal products, meats, to basically get B12 in your diet. Because remember, folate is from foliage, it's from plants, but B12 is from animals. And then after you consume it, that B12, some of it will bind to some salivary proteins. And then it will make its way down your esophagus all the way to your stomach. When it gets to your stomach, the acidity of the stomach is actually pretty necessary in helping you split off vitamin B12 from salivary binding proteins, also in helping you split off vitamin B12 from dietary proteins. That splitting off is very important, right? And you need the acidity of the stomach to make that happen. At the same time, in the stomach, the parietal cells are making intrinsic factor, but the binding between intrinsic factor and vitamin B12 does not happen until you get to the small intestine. In the small intestine, you actually need pancreatic enzymes as well, again, to basically break off B12 from something called a R factor. Because the thing is, B12 cannot safely on its own make its way from the mouth all the way to the small intestine. It actually binds to something called R factor. R factor helps it to keep going safely until it gets to the small intestine. So to get that R factor off of B12, we need pancreatic enzymes to make that happen. And then once B12 is split off from R factor, it can then bind with intrinsic factor. And then they'll be reabsorbed through transcobalamin 2 receptors in the terminal ileum, and then it will go into the body. Most of the B12 you have in your body is actually stored in the liver. The liver stores about 3 to 5 years worth of vitamin B12. So that is the normal physiology of vitamin B12. That is the normal physiology of vitamin B12. The thing is, if you understand the normal physiology of vitamin B12, then understanding the pathology that underlies B12 deficiency becomes very easy, right? So What are some things that can potentially cause vitamin B12 deficiency? What are some things that could potentially cause it? Well, the first thing is impaired absorption. The most common cause is very high yield to know. The most common cause of B12 deficiency is you're not absorbing it properly, right? And again, you're not absorbing it properly can have many, many different causes, right? Again, alternatively, and we'll talk about those causes, but let me talk about the other ones, right? Or you may not be consuming enough vitamin B12, right? So if you're vegan, if you're vegetarian, right? I'll say vegans especially, right? These are people that are more likely to develop B12 deficiency, again, because they just don't consume adequate amounts of animal products. Another unusual cause of B12 deficiency you may see on your exam is when a person B12, because normally we said that, you know, the B12 that your liver can store can kind of keep you going for like 3 to 5 years. But if for some reason, right? So just kind of think about it. Let's say hospitals. We know that hospitals back in the day before COVID-19 started didn't have to use N95 masks as often, right? It's probably something that was used maybe just in the ICU or if you're taking care of some special patient populations. But with COVID-19, let's say a hospital before, the N95 supply could last them for like 10 years. But then because of COVID-19, that previous 10-year supply of N95s runs out in 2 days, right? Obviously, they would develop an N95 deficiency very quickly. That's the same thing that happens in people that have like these hemolytic anemias. Because normally your red blood cells are supposed to live for 4 months, 120 days. But if something bad really happens, right, and you have like a hemolytic anemia, like an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, remember that's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Or if you have like, you know, sickle cell disease, hereditary spherocytosis, in those cases, these people's B12 stores deplete very quickly. And think about it, if your body has about 3 to 5 years worth of B12 and about 3 months or thereabouts of folate, you can see that those people develop folate a lot quicker, folate deficiency a lot quicker than their B12 deficiency. This is why in general, if you have a hemolytic anemia, you require daily folate supplementation. That rule does not necessarily apply to B12, but you can already see why these people can develop a B12 deficiency. And also people that have AIDS, because again, their cell turnover is really, really high. Those people can develop a B12 deficiency very quickly. Now, so what are some other causes of B12 deficiency? So I said I'm going to talk about the causes of B12 deficiency that deal with absorption. Again, if you understand that physiology of B12 deficiency I described, a lot of this should make perfect sense, right? So a classic one, right, probably like the most common one that pops up on MBM exams is when for some reason you have an intrinsic factor deficiency, right? And what are the things that can cause intrinsic factor deficiency? Well, basically anything that messes up with your stomach will cause an intrinsic factor deficiency. The chief one, right, obviously is pernicious anemia, where you make autoantibodies against the parietal cells, or you make autoantibodies against the intrinsic factor. The thing that's going to happen in those circumstances, right, is you're either destroying the parietal cells that make IF or destroying intrinsic factor itself. Then B12 will not have that partner that it needs to be reabsorbed by transcobalamin 2 receptors in the terminal ileum of the small intestine, right? Or think about it, if for some reason you resect the stomach, right? Like you perform a gastrectomy, right? So they can easily make this a surgery shelf question. That's the thing, B12 deficiency just kind of percolates into many different subjects, right? So if you perform a gastrectomy, basically you're resecting the part of the stomach, again, that can cause, that harbors those parietal cells. Obviously, that's going to cause a B12 deficiency as well. Another classic one is if you do certain kinds of weight loss surgery, right? So let's say you do like the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, right? The Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. That's basically where you pretty much, you know, make a small, you essentially divide the stomach into like a small upper pouch and a large, you know, lower part of the stomach, which is kind of like your remnant pouch, right? And then you essentially make your small intestine connect to both pouches, that small upper pouch and the larger remnant pouch, right? So the thing is, again, by doing that, you're essentially going to be causing a B12 deficiency because your small intestine doesn't really have much access anymore to that B12 that's coming from the parietal cells. So those things can absolutely cause a B12 deficiency, right? Or if you, for example, have a problem with like the terminal ileum, right? So say, for example, Crohn's disease. Remember, Crohn's disease loves to torch the terminal ileum. Or if you have some form of, if you have some malabsorptive disorder, right? Like celiac disease, Whipple's disease, right? Those things can all mess up your terminal ileum. If you mess up your terminal ileum, again, you're not going to be able to reabsorb vitamin B12. And also, if a person has a transcobalamin 2 deficiency, right, they can easily make this a step one question because it's a genetic disease, right? Transcobalamin 2 deficiency, those are the receptors that you need to be able to get in B12, an intrinsic factor, through the terminal ileum into the body, right? So that can obviously cause a B12 deficiency. Now, if for some reason you also have a low acid in your stomach, right, that's going to cause a B12 deficiency, although this, you have to be on these drugs for a really long period of time, right? So like if you're on a PPI, right, like a proton pump inhibitor, or you're on a H2 blocker, right, like ranitidine, famotidine, things like that. These things, again, are acid reducers in your stomach, right? Again, if you have low amounts of acid, you're not going to be able to split up vitamin B12 from, you're not going to be able to split up B12 from your dietary proteins, and also from salivary binding proteins, right? So those things can all give rise to a person having a B12 deficiency. Another classic one is, if for example you have like just bacterial overgrowth in your GI tract, right? Bacterial overgrowth in your GI tract, that can absolutely cause a B12 deficiency, because bacteria, many people think it's only the fish tapeworm, and I'll talk about that in a bit, but it's not only fish tapeworm that eats B12. The bacteria in your GI tract, if they overgrow, they can become significant enough to pretty much consume your vitamin B12, right? In fact, there's this thing called a blind loop syndrome, right? Sometimes it happens after some GI surgeries, this blind loop syndrome, where it happens where essentially in these circumstances, the person just has like a part of their small intestine that is just kind of static, right? Nothing seems to be moving along in those places. When nothing is moving along, then bacteria is going to overgrow. Because the thing is, just literally that peristalsis, that movement of food through your GI tract, literally like moves the bacteria along. Just kind of keeps everything going smoothly, right? So the thing is, when you have that blind loop syndrome, then you have a buildup of bacteria. And as you build up that bacteria, right, those gut microbes, they can again consume your B12 and cause vitamin B12 deficiency, right? Metformin, right, that we use to treat diabetes, right, type 2 diabetes, can also cause a B12 deficiency, right? And also, if a person has like, and they will usually give you these people having like big time eosinophilia, if a person has a fish tapeworm infection, remember Diphyllobothrium latum, those things can all cause a vitamin B12 deficiency, right? So again, it's very high O2. And also, if your pancreas doesn't work, right, because remember we said that to cut off vitamin B12 from R binder, you need pancreatic enzymes, right? So the thing is, if your pancreas doesn't work, let's say you have chronic pancreatitis, or your pancreas is dead for some reason, right, that can cause a B12 deficiency. So you see that there are many potential ways they can test B12 deficiency on an in-beam exam, right? So the thing is, you may be like, okay, Divine, like, why do we care about B12 deficiency? Well, B12 deficiency can certainly cause quite a number of problems, right? As you'll see, B12 is important for two chemical reactions in the body. The first one is important for is in the formation of methionine, right? So again, so far we've talked about the normal physiology, we've talked about the causes of B12 deficiency, right? So let's actually go into the diagnostic testing for B12 deficiency, but I want to give some quick background here, right? So remember that to make methionine, right, with an enzyme called methionine synthase, you need vitamin B12, right? You need cobalamin. Right? You need vitamin B12 for that reaction to work. So if you have a B12 deficiency, that's not going to work. So you're not going to be able to convert homocysteine to methionine. So your homocysteine is going to build up, right? One of the most common causes of hyperhomocysteinemia is B12 deficiency. But then remember, if you also want to convert methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA with methylmalonyl-CoA mutase, you need vitamin B12 to make that reaction work. Right? The thing is, of those two reactions, folate is also helpful for homocysteine to methionine conversion. So the thing is, B12 folate deficiency will both cause hyperhomocysteinemia. But B12 deficiency is the sole cause, well, besides the another genetic disease, but vitamin B12 deficiency is the sole cause, again, besides, I guess, methylmalonyl-CoA mutase deficiency that can cause a person to have a methylmalonic acidemia. So whenever you see a person having hyperhomocysteinemia, check their methylmalonic acid levels. If it's elevated, that tells you it's a B12 deficiency. If it's not elevated, then that tells you it's likely going to be some kind of folate deficiency, right? So the thing is, you may wonder, oh, the vine, if methylmalonic acid builds up, it's not a big deal. Well, it's a big deal. One is it can give you a metabolic acidosis. That's one. But two, methylmalonic acid, when it builds up, makes your myelin more fragile, makes it less stable, right? So those people begin to have like demyelinative problems, right? Because their neurons don't work right. Because again, remember, you need myelin to help you with that saltatory conduction business with your neurons. So neuronal transmission becomes a huge issue, right? So how do we diagnose B12 deficiency? Again, I've pretty much talked about it already, right? You can check the person's homocysteine levels. You can check their vitamin B12 levels. You can check their methylmalonic acid levels. The thing is, checking the vitamin B12 levels, right, is obviously like a smart, easy thing to do, right? But again, it would make sense that the NBME would not put that on an exam. It would make more sense that they make you do the chemical analysis with these homocysteine levels and the methylmalonic acid levels. So that's something I'd expect more on your exam. And then there's one smart thing our friends at the NBME love to do. They love to talk about this thing called the Schilling's test. The thing is, most people these days, most clinicians, do not perform the Schilling's test. But the Schilling's test is kind of a high yield test to understand because it's like a B12 deficiency localized the lesion test, right? It's like a B12 deficiency localized the lesion test. They still put these things on exams, whether you like it or not. They put it on step one, put it on step two, CK, put it on step three. So doesn't mean that no one performs it, but very few people perform it, right? So it's something you kind of want to understand because it really, really helps you localize why a person has a vitamin B12 deficiency, right? So the thing is, the test has many different variants, but I'm just going to give you the variant that will help you on your exam. So what's the variant? So how do we do this test, right? This test is kind of done in a laddered process. So the first step in said process is to give the person like intramuscular vitamin B12. The reason you do that is you want to basically saturate all the person's B12 stores, right? You just want to tell the body that, oh, B12 is saturated, right? The reason you do that is, again, if you give that iron vitamin B12, it will saturate basically all the B12 receptors or stores, you know, like in the liver and stuff like that, right? So the thing is, for a normal human being, if I saturate all your B12 stores and then I give you oral vitamin B12, that oral vitamin B12 is going to get reabsorbed in the terminal ileum, and then it's going to show up in your urine. Usually, you're looking for about 10% of what you took orally. So let's say you took 100 milligrams of vitamin B12. You want about 10 milligrams of it roughly in your urine, above 10 milligrams of it, 10 milligrams or more in your urine. If you don't see that much in your urine, then that means something is going on, right? So again, in the first step, you're going to give that iron vitamin B12 to, again, pretty much saturate the body with vitamin B12, right? And then in the second step, you're then going to go ahead and give those people oral vitamin B12. And you'd be like, oh, Divine, how do they track this B12 they're given? How do they differentiate it from the one that was given by IM injection? Well, the thing is, the one given by IM injection is going to be normal vitamin B12 that contains normal cobalt. But then the one you give orally is radio-labeled. Right? Because remember, vitamin B12 is also called cobalamin. The co stands for cobalt. Cobalt, there are actually some radioactive isotopes of cobalt. It's pretty low radioactivity, so it's not that big of a deal. But basically, this person will get radio-labeled cobalt. And then that radio-labeled cobalt will be the thing, again, that goes in the oral B12. So if, for example, you give the person... that iron vitamin B12, and then after that you give them the oral B12, and you notice that, gee, man, I don't see any of this vitamin B12 in the person's urine, then that makes your life easy. That tells you that, you know what, this person likely has some kind of B12 deficiency. It tells you that there is some reabsorption defect with B12 deficiency. So that's the second step, right? Because again, if I give you an oral B12 and you were a normal human being, then that B12 should show up in your urine. But if it doesn't show up, then there is something going on. There is something going on. So what do you do in the third step? In the third step, what you're going to do is you're going to give intrinsic factor. You're going to give oral intrinsic factor, right? If you give oral intrinsic factor, well, there are one of two results you can get. You can get the fact that, oh, I give you oral intrinsic factor. I give you that radio-labeled oral B12. And voila, your vitamin B12 deficiency resolves, right? You see it in the urine, right? You notice that, wow, okay, I'm seeing more than 10% of what I give orally in the urine. Then that's good. Then that tells you that it's an intrinsic factor deficiency that caused the person's vitamin B12 deficiency. So that pretty much tells you the person has pernicious anemia and you're done. But if for some reason you notice that, gee, I gave this person oral vitamin B12 and I gave intrinsic factor and I didn't see that B12 show up in the urine, then that tells you that, it's not intrinsic factor deficiency that is causing this person's problem. You've pretty much crossed off pernicious anemia as the cause of the person's vitamin B12 deficiency. So typically after that, what are you going to do next? Many times, the thing that's done next, and again, to be honest with you, this part where you give intrinsic factor, about 99.99999% of the time, is where the NBME will stop. But for completeness sake, some other permutations that I used, like the next stage, typically is you'll give that oral vitamin B12 and antibiotics. Because again, some people, as I described, bacterial overgrowth can cause B12 deficiency. You give them like a two-week course of antibiotics that will kill off all that bacteria, right? And then hopefully, if you give B12 an intrinsic factor, that should fix the problem, right? So giving antibiotics, again, can help you rule out bacterial overgrowth as the cause of the person's B12 deficiency. Many times in the next stage after that, let's say you give antibiotics, it still doesn't fix the problem, right? Then one thing that's classically done is you can give the person like pancreatic enzymes, right? You give it like 3 days worth of pancreatic enzymes. Because again, remember, you need pancreatic enzymes to split up vitamin B12 from a R binder, right? So if you give pancreatic enzymes and then you notice that, oh, you now see the B12 in the person's urine. Again, you give pancreatic enzymes plus oral, you know, radio labeled B12. Then that tells you that, okay, this person likely has a chronic pancreatitis or something weird with their pancreas that's causing them to have that B12 deficiency. So, but again, the part up to where I described the intrinsic factor, it's kind of like the big thing. What you're doing with the Schilling's test is you're giving oral B12 and then you're just subbing out different things to see if, oh, if I change this one variable, it fixes it. You see B12 in the urine. That basically tells you, helps you localize the lesion as to why the person has a B12 deficiency. So hopefully you understand the Schilling's test. Again, it's one of these diagnostic tests you can use for B12 deficiency. But again, people don't really use it clinically, but it shows up abundantly on NBME exams. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is the pathology of B12 deficiency, right? So why is B12 deficiency a problem? Well, again, I told you that first things first, you need B12 to make methionine, right? Methionine is kind of necessary for making neurotransmitters, right? So many times people that have B12 deficiency, they tend to have like depression. They tend to have these neuropsych disorders, right? Because again, the neurotransmitters are not being made in adequate quantity. Second one is, remember, you need B12, again, to make methionine, which is necessary, right, purine and thymidine synthesis. So if that doesn't work, then you're going to be in big trouble, right? Because the person is not going to have like DNA synthesis, right? So your cells can keep getting big. Because many times, remember, when you're about to undergo cell division, the cell will almost like double in size, right? And then it will double its DNA content, right? And usually that doubling in size happens before the doubling in DNA content. So if your cell doubles in size, like gets bigger, but then you notice that, wow, I can't make the DNA, right? Your cell will be big with like little DNA to meet that new big cell requirement, right? So these people tend to get like megaloblastic anemia. And the thing is, many people for some reason think that it's only like these people's red blood cells that get big. No, that's not true, right? Many other cells in the body get big. Like literally epithelial cells in multiple tissues of the body will get big in people that have a vitamin B12 deficiency. So that's just something to keep in mind, right? And then remember, again, as I said, you need B12 to make sure that myelin's integrity is preserved, right? So if, for example, again, you have a B12 deficiency, methylmalonic acid will build up and make your myelin more fragile, and your myelin will not work as well, right? So it begins to affect different parts of the body, right? The big, big thing I want you to keep in mind here is subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. Well, what do I mean by subacute combined degeneration? Well, it's a degeneration of two things, right? The first one is going to be the dorsal columns, right? And then the second thing is going to be your lateral corticospinal tract. Those things depend heavily on appropriate myelin function. So these people have loss of touch, vibration, and proprioception, right? They will have losses of touch, vibration, and proprioception. And then they will also have upper motor neuron symptoms like the Babinski sign, hyperreflexia, muscle hypertonia, things like that, right? And again, because their dorsal columns don't work, right, those people have a positive Romberg test, right? Because remember, the Romberg test is a test of dorsal column function, not cerebellar function. Basically, what's the Romberg test? Essentially, what the Romberg test is you pretty much need three things. There are three things in the body that tell your joints where they are in space. And of those three things, you need two to be working at every single point in time for you to not topple over, right? So what are those three things? Well, one is your vision, two is your dorsal columns, and then three is cranial nerve 8, your vestibulocochlear nerve. So if, for example, a person's dorsal column doesn't work, right? Let's say because they have B12 deficiency, or they have a tertiary syphilis with tibis dorsalis or whatever, right? Then those people are still going to be able to stand up straight. No big deal, right? Because their vision is still there. Cranial 8 is still there. But then if you call them into your office, tell them to close their eyes, then they're going to topple over because now their vision is gone, right? Their dorsal columns are already gone. So the only thing that's left is cranial nerve 8, the vestibulocochlear nerve. And you need 2 out of 3, not 1 out of 3. So those people fall over. That's a very good test for dorsal column function, right? So those are the different pathologies that are associated with a person having a B12 deficiency. And there's many, many other things that are caused by B12 deficiency, but we're not really going to go into that because they're not particularly high yield to know for the USMLE exams. And again, how do you treat B12 deficiency? Many times you're just going to start off with like a big mega dose of B12. And then after that, you go to like a smaller dose. That's, again, essentially how you're going to treat B12 deficiency on NBME exams. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many USMLE exams, step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And also, if you need help with your ERAS applications, again, I know ERAS season has essentially kind of got in full gear. I mean, I've been booked out already for many sessions with people for these ERAS applications, right? So like personal statements, editing your ERAS app, stuff like that, mock interviews. Again, I do this with people. And again, it's probably even more realistic now, especially with this Zoom cycles that we're going to be going through probably for the foreseeable future. So if you're interested in any of those things, or even the Step 2 CK course that I have coming up this week, Step 2 CK Step 3 course, just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more details on cost and how my teaching modalities are. Again, I've worked with tons of students that have matched into many competitive specialties for many years, right? And again, I have admissions committee experience, right? So I'm very good with these processes. I'm very good with kind of making sure your application is as high yield as possible, focuses on things that will make you more marketable, more desirable with programs. And then again, many of you know that I'm a Christian. So I have this, I used to talk about life lessons at the end of my regular podcast, and I'll still continue to do those. But I have a divine intervention on lifelessons.com website that you can go to and you'll find life lessons. In fact, so far, I think I've made like 8 podcasts. All of them are under 10 minutes long. And, you just learn some very good Bible-based teaching. You can almost use like a devotional to just teach you key things about life. Just key life lessons that are applicable, not just to medical professionals, but to pretty much everyone. And I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And that's where I put all my videos, although the slides that go with those videos are on the website under the respective episodes, right? DivineInterventionPodcasts.com. So subscribe to the YouTube channel. If I make any new podcasts, if I make any videos, they are going to be on there. And then again, if you subscribe to the website, DivineInterventionPodcast.com, you'll get every episode, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And also every podcast from episode 1 all the way to this one, episode 328, is there. Because, by the way, I also have these podcasts on, Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. So you can get them on there. The only problem is the most recent 150 podcasts you'll get. So since this is episode 328, if I'm doing my math right, everything from episode 1 to episode 177, you won't be on the podcast apps, right? So you can find those on the website. It's a WordPress role. There's really not much. I've tried. Trust me. There's really not much I can do to circumvent those rules. And again, the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast is on Apple Podcast as well. So the life lesson I just want to share today is the importance of working in the secret place, right? So what do I mean by working in the secret place? Working in the secret place just means keeping a level head, doing good work, even when no one is watching, right? So the thing is, many times people want the glory of life without going through the story of life. What do I mean by that? The thing I mean by that is when people see, for example, LeBron James coming out and just really crushing it on the court, or Anthony Davis coming out and really crushing it on the court, or Steph Curry coming out and just swishing all those threes, they think it just happened because they just have some natural ability. Yes, they probably have some natural ability. But the thing is, natural ability is not going to do you much if you don't spend time building up your craft. So you need to work in the secret place. Many people are not willing to do that secret place work. That work that almost looks mundane, looks dry, looks boring, right? That work that no one is seeing them, right? But the thing is, they know how big they want to perform on the world stage. So they put in that work in the secret place, right? They put in that work in the secret place. Or you see a person that has like good shape, good physique, good weight, very healthy. Again, those people are putting in work in the secret place. It may not always feel good, right? Again, the thing is, doing the right thing may not always feel right. But doing the right thing is always the right thing to do. So those people, you see them attending to their diets and working out every day. No one may be seeing them. But then you see them outside, you know, they have good weights, good BMIs, good everything. And then you wonder what's happening, right? And then you become jealous. Don't get jealous. No. Go and perform your own life story. Go and work hard in the secret place and you'll get similar results, right? Or you see people doing well on step 2 CK, step 3, step 1, getting 270s and stuff, right? And you're feeling jealous and you're like, ah. And then you're trying to do all these things to subdue those people. No. Those people worked hard in the secret place. They cranked through those Anki decks. They watched those videos. They listened to those podcasts. They read those things. They did all those Q-banks. They spent time on those MBME practice exams. They did all that analysis, right? The thing is, many times in life, you can achieve big things by just doing mundane, boring things consistently that other people do not want to do. So I'll encourage you, do that secret place work. And you will succeed on the big stage. And with God on your side, you can do some really, really great things. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.